This is Wheel Bearings. I'm Dan Roth from Forbes.
I'm Sam Abu Al-Samad from Navigant Research.
And I'm Rebecca Lindland from Rebecca Drives.
And we are all from Twit Car Reviews, so check it out because it's fun. I'm just going to keep plugging that over and over, over again.
Well, actually, as long as we're plugging stuff, before we dive into the topics, let's give the listeners a couple of updates. I recently moved this whole site over to a new website hosting provider, which should be much more reliable than in the past. And in the process, also set up some new email addresses for the show. So you can now reach us at feedback@wheelbearings.media. So the site is still the same address, wheelbearings.media, as it's always been. But you can email us at feedback@wheelbearings.media, or you can reach any of us individually at Dan, Rebecca, or Sam at wheelbearings.media.
All right. And so the correspondence will come pouring in, I hope. and because we love our listeners and our fans, I think actually what I would like to do is every single listener should take the time to send an email. Just, hi, I'm here.
Yeah. Let us know you exist.
Right. I think, and just copy all three of us and we'll just get a bunch of hello worlds.
Exactly.
Fascinating.
And tell us where you usually listen to it. Like what your location is. That
yeah.
That'd be fun too.
Yeah. And your device. And you know what, while you're at it, just give us your household income and, we'll turn it into a survey.
And what you drive, and yeah, and never mind. Okay, let's get
into
it. What
do you like?
It.
Long walks on the beach? Oh no, that's not right.
Who doesn't?
Wrong site, Rebecca.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Well, as we head into Thanksgiving, which I'm ready for because it's about food. It's the most American holiday because it's about food and with a side of subjugation. But beyond that, let's talk about the cars we're thankful to drive, like the cars we're driving this week. What are you guys in? Rebecca, why don't you go first?
So I was in the 2020 Mazda 3 compact four-door sedan. And we have talked a lot on this program about Mazda and its price points. This one actually starts at $21,500 for the very base model.
That's
the
good.
One that I had, which is very good. The one that I had was fully loaded, of course. It had all-wheel drive, which is absolutely fantastic in a compact car. And it topped out at $30,645, including destination. So it really comes in at just under $29,000 and change. I'm sorry, it comes under $30,000 without destination. I've ragged on Mazda a lot about their price points, but I have to say that this was an absolute delight to drive. It was so solid. I really forgot that I was in a compact car a lot of times. Like it was so solid. It was quiet. It was comfortable. And I never minded hopping in it and running around and doing my errands and going, you know, doing all the crazy stuff I have to do in any given week. And it just was really, really, really nice. So kudos to Mazda. I think that they did a fantastic job. The interior is absolutely beautiful. Mine had a combination of a black base around it with these gorgeous white seat, heated seats, which I am a total sucker for white leather. You can tell I don't have children. it was just really nice. Huge sunroof, you know, nice sized tires. Everything about it really, really was good.
It's at 30,000 with all wheel drive. I don't think there's that many other all wheel drive compact sedans, first of all.
I don't think
no,
so.
No, like
I think
Subaru's about it, really.
Yeah. I would so much rather drive the
I know.
Mazda.
the only issue that I did have with it was, and I'd be curious if you guys have experienced this. So obviously it's, you know, mid-November and the sun sets quite early. And I had really
I hadn't
bad
noticed that.
Sun glare. I had really bad sun glare in the afternoons. And it was a combination because I knew I wanted to talk about it. So I really tried to observe. It's a combination of the dash is very large. And of course, it's black, which they always are. But it's still reflected quite aggressively onto the windscreen. And I don't know if it's just the slope of the windscreen, but it was And it wasn't that the windshield was dirty or anything. It was just really noticeable. It was totally fine on rainy days, of which we've had many. But the couple of days that I did drive it, it had the sun glare was really pretty bad. And I didn't know if you guys had experienced that.
I drove the three, I guess, about a month and a half, 2 months ago. And I had not noticed that at the time, which is not to say that, you know, it wouldn't be there, you know, if I tried it now, you know, under current conditions, but I hadn't noticed that as a problem at the time.
And I also do wonder, you know, obviously I sit very differently than you would sit, if that's a problem as well. But I'd love to hear from people if they've driven the Mazda 3, if they have one, or if they've had this experience at all. The A-pillar does encroach a bit, but, you know, I've had worse. And again, I try and sit at a balance between, you know, I typically will stretch my arm out. I'll break my wrist over the steering wheel and try and get that balance between.
Well, that is proper.
I'm sorry?
That is proper. That's how you're supposed to do it.
It is proper. I take my driving position very seriously.
Excellent. No, nobody else does.
You know, so I try and kind of do that balance between safety and where I need to sit and, you know, just getting all the ergonomics correct. But it was something that I really, you know, I observed it the first day, which happened to be a sunny day. We had several days of cloudy days in a row, so I didn't have that issue. But then it happened again the other day. And I was like, wow, this is just, you know, it was bad. And I don't know if it's just the combination of the type of time of year it is. You know,
was again, it all just, times of the day or
was,
just like
it was
near
pretty
dusk?
Much all times of the day. Hmm. It was particularly noticeable in the late afternoon, but it was definitely, I was driving it in the morning as well, and it was definitely noticeable in the morning also. And again, it's kind of one of those things, I felt like it was the angle of the windscreen.
Yeah, that's probably part of it, is angle of the windshield and where you are. I mean, it's like you're setting up kind of an optical system at that point, right? So,
right.
When you wear sunglasses, are they polarized?
So, you know, I have corrective lenses and they have the tint to them. And my sunglasses are too big and I typically don't wear them. So I just rely on the glasses that I have and then they tint down.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a very fair question. And I'll dig them out and see the next time, especially with heads up display, because I know, Sam, you have that a lot, which this car had and was fantastic.
Does it have a heads up display that bounces off the windshield, or the one that puts a little piece of plastic up?
No, it's the proper one that bounces off the windshield. Nice. And it's a larger display than what you get with those, with the flip up ones, which are lower cost. And, you know, it allows manufacturers to put it into lower end vehicles, but they're not as effective.
They're not as good. But yeah, so I think the glare on the windshield issue, polarized filters, polarized sunglasses will probably help it. But if you have corrective lenses, obviously that's an issue where they're not generally polarized. I suffer through solar glare with all of the cars to a certain degree, just the time of day that I'm driving.
Sure.
If I'm driving either
on the Mass
morning,
Pike is no. I mean, night. Do you go on the Mass Pike?
I don't do the Pike, but I do 128 and I do Route 9. Okay. And so I go everywhere but the Pike.
Well, Route 9 is, I mean, parallel to the Pike. So you're going to run into the same idea.
Yep. Some cars are worse than others. But I do find that polarized sunglasses help cut that glare a lot.
Yeah.
It's probably the angle of the windshield more than just about anything. You know, the cars that I've had that have had sort of faster windshield angles tend to have that issue. And this doesn't look it's very upright.
No, it's definitely not upright. It's not. And,
Rebecca?
Yeah.
One other question, you know, just in general about visibility, you know, this new generation 3, you know, has a fairly high belt line and, you know, you're, you know, not as tall as I am, to put it mildly. And so I'm just curious, in general with visibility, the one I drove, the three that I drove had was the hatchback. I think in the case of the sedan, it might be slightly better, but not much. So I'm just curious how the visibility was for you.
You know, it's so funny that you say that because it was not great. And maybe that is because of the high belt line, but the the rear window was okay, but you're absolutely right. I mean, I didn't feel like this car had great visibility in it. It's not the same, but like the Ford Escape that does have a lower beltline now, there was a lot of visibility in that vehicle. Obviously, it sits up higher as well, but I never felt like I was sitting on the ground in this Mazda. I mean, that was one of the things that I liked about it, was that it has such confidence on the road that I didn't feel like I was in a tiny little compact car. But the visibility was definitely something that I struggled with a little bit.
Yeah, there's definitely not as much glass area in this current generation of three.
Yeah. I mean, it's not a reason to not buy it. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't like that. And again, I do think that, you know, again, like how I try and sit, though, I do sit fairly high, you know, and it wasn't that there wasn't, it wasn't that I didn't feel like there was, that I couldn't see at any time, but I didn't have I certainly didn't have that feeling of expansive spaciousness, and the rear, both the rear and the front visibility were not my favorites. With that being said, I mean, I used to have Acura Integras that had that really slit, you know, narrow slit. I've had a Fiat 500. I mean, I've had cars, a convertible. I've had cars that don't have great rear window visibility, but, and that kind of, because I even noticed that at all, says something about that. That is definitely something that to consider on a test drive of the Mazda 3 to make sure you're comfortable with it.
And, you know, to be fair, visibility straight out the rear on most new cars has become significantly compromised because they tend to have taller rear decks, you know, that very, you know, in most cases, you know, that sloped rear glass. And so the vertical field of view through that rear window tends to be fairly limited. And now, you know, in modern cars, you also have rear seat headrests, which also significantly reduces it. And in the case of the 3, you know, this new generation 3, while it's a great looking car, it does have a higher belt line. And on the hatchback in particular, you know, it really sweeps up that belt line, on the rear doors, the sheet metal sweeps up a lot more towards the back edge of the door. Whereas in the sedan, it kind of, the bottom edge of the glass tends to stay, you know, more along a straight line all the way,
right,
sweeping
it
back
stays
into
along
the rear,
that belt
into the
line.
Trunk lid. Yeah.
Yeah. It stays along the belt line as opposed to sweeping up.
Yeah. So in the sedan, you know, the C pillars are not as substantial as they are on the hatchback.
Yeah.
Well, people like feeling cocooned like that too. They feel safer in the, and, you know, for side impact, it's better, or somewhat easier.
Yeah,
I don't agree.
That's debatable.
I think there's a compromise.
That was at least the explanation for some of the high belt line, was if you have metal there instead of glass, it's easier to pass those side impact tests. That may not be so, but it seemed good to me, who is not a, you know, a crash engineer.
Yeah, I would say, you know, purely from a mechanical standpoint, that's probably true. You know, the more sheet metal you have there as opposed to glass, you know, it is going to tend, it's probably going to be easier to pass the side impact test.
Yeah, and
that said, you know, you're also compromising on safety. You know, visibility is a significant impact on safety.
Oh, I agree, absolutely. I'd rather be able to see.
You know, if you can't see around you, you know, then, you know, you're more likely to hit something because you can't see it.
It's a trap. It's a trap. It's a scam. You see, here's what's going on. They're taking away the windows from us so they can sell us sensor packages. That's what's going on. You don't need to look. You don't need to see out the windows. Don't trust your lying eyes and ears. Look at the light on the A pillar.
Yeah.
Look at the light.
All right, it's just a thought. But, you know, that psychological feeling of being sort of like snuggled up in this, like, you know, metal envelope, I guess, is something that appeals to some people. It drives me bonkers because I see out of the car.
Well, and it also is design-wise, you know, the high beltline, narrow greenhouse, you know, we've all written those words dozens of times. You know, that's the look, and it's a cool look, but it doesn't help visibility.
Yeah.
And fortunately, I think that, you know, that is a trend that's starting to reverse a little bit, at least with some manufacturers. And I think, you know, over the coming years, we'll probably see, you know, a little bit more balance there between the glass and sheet metal, or a little bit better balance between glass and sheet metal. You know, as you mentioned, Rebecca, the new Escape and the Corsair, Lincoln Corsair, you know, they have definitely moved towards a lower belt line. And I think we're going to start seeing other manufacturers do that as well.
Yeah, and they've done it in such a way that it doesn't compromise the design. I mean, I think that both the Escape and the Corsair are really nice looking vehicles. So, you know, every little centimeter or millimeter counts. And so I think they've done a nice job of just bringing the beltline down a little bit and still having that cocoon type of feel. I mean, I don't ever remember feeling unsafe or feeling exposed when I was driving both of those vehicles. So I think it's a balance.
It's kind of the opposite of driving my car, as you know, Rebecca.
Yes, exactly.
Your car with unlimited headroom.
Half of your body is out of your car.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. There's no cocoon feeling in my first generation Miata.
You know,
and it's interesting what you get used to, because one of the sort of like most terrifying automotive experiences I've ever had was riding in a tea bucket, a custom tea bucket. It's really cool. It was built on a chopped down Model A frame and it had a Mazda 12A rotary and it was very small. The body was just one ply of fiberglass. and we're in Worcester for the car show. And so that's fine. But you get used to it really quick and you just like you ride around in it and you feel like, yeah, this thing's going to contain me. But if you hit anything, you're airborne. There were no seat belts. I think the windshield might have been plate glass at that time, so the safety glass.
Have you ever driven a Wrangler with the doors off?
Yes, it's actually pretty good with the doors off, but it you feel very vulnerable. Oh,
except for the turbulence.
Yeah,
there's a lot of wind turbulence around the sides there when you take the doors off because of that, you know, flat windshield and just the way the thing is shaped. You know, the wind just swirls around in the cabin when you take those doors off.
Yeah, that's why it's so great in the summer, you know. And they make like pegs that you can stick your foot just outside of the body, mm-hmm. just like
a motorcycle.
Yeah, just like it fits with the Wrangler crowd, I suppose. But it's just kind of funny. And then you think about again, if anything happens, like your foot and your ankle, and probably like the whole lower part of your leg below the knee is the first mm-hmm. to go. So yep. Enjoy it while you've got it.
Fortunately, Wranglers are have a much reduced predilection to rolling over than they used to.
Yeah, that's true. They're not unstable at all. No.
No.
It's the drivers. all right. Let's. What else did we need to say about the Mazda 3 while we're on the subject? Did we? Because we got a little off point, but overall, yeah. You know, what did you think of the?
It was all related, though.
It was all. It's some. There's a common thread. The infotainment to me is sort of a stumbling block for Mazda because it's kind of like iDrive, but it's kind of not. It's not a touchscreen.
Yeah. I definitely had some interface. I described it as clumsy in my review. And then Android Auto, sometimes it would work and sometimes it wouldn't. It was very arbitrary. Like I was so pleased because the first time I dialed up, I was like, okay, good. Here it is. I plugged it in, got everything up and running, put down my phone and bam, it was gone. And I could never get it back for like 3 days. And then all of a sudden it was back again. I'm like, oh, great. Okay. I guess we're friends again. And
you know what I've found on a number of cars with Android Auto is the USB connections tend to be somewhat flaky.
Okay.
And, yeah, you know, sometimes if I swap out to a different USB cable, it works just fine.
I do know that, but the thing is that it worked perfectly. Like it was.
Oh, I know. I've had exactly the same thing. You know, where it works absolutely perfectly. And then all of a sudden, you know, even as you're driving along, you know, the Android Auto screen will go away.
Yes.
And the only way to get it back is to unplug and plug back in, you know, or sometimes even then it doesn't come back. And, you know, if you've got a cable that you've been using for a while, especially in the car where it's more likely to get wound up into weird, you know, bent, you know, and some of the wires inside the cable may get fractured.
Sure.
It tends to be much less stable. And that's why I'm looking forward to the onset of vehicles that have wireless support for both CarPlay and Android Auto. And those are starting to come to market now, including the Escape and the Corsair.
Yeah, that will be really nice. So I definitely had some issues with that. I listened to a lot of Billy Joel channel because I just couldn't be bothered to figure out how to change it.
and then every version of Goodnight Saigon ever recorded.
Exactly. And then I did eventually go through the several steps to do that. I found, you know, and again, this is a little bit of an ergonomics. I found that the center console where they have the dial and where the buttons are, I found it was, again, this is because of how I sit, but it sat really far back for me. Like I had to, it's funny, I'm actually making the motion now. Like I had to like physically like move my arm back, move my elbow back in between the seats because it was just set kind of far back for me. And you know, it was just uncomfortable and I had to look down a lot to see it. Now, with that being said, I loved the heads up display and I loved the fact that it gave directions and it gave signage and my speed. So I didn't have to look down a lot, thankfully, but when I did, it was not a comfortable reach for me.
When you say look down, you mean look down for the dial or
right for the dial and the buttons and stuff. And, you know, whether I wanted to go to home or get the map back up or, you know, I literally like I changed the radio channel like twice because it was so annoying. So but
yeah, well, I think that's one of those things.
You can program your favorites in and stuff, you know, like you can personalize it. So,
yeah, well, and I think that's one of those things where, you know, once you've spent a little more time with it and get accustomed to the what those four buttons around the dial are, it's really something you can do without looking at it.
It is. You know, it is
because
for
it's,
sure.
It's directly, you know, that dial is directly behind the shift lever, you know, so I mean, you drop your hand down there. Yeah. I mean, in your case, you know, I can understand, you know, where just because of your seating position, it might ergonomically, it might be a little bit further back than is comfortable for you. But in general, you know, just being able to drop your hand down on it and twist and push and pull on that dial and tap those buttons, you'll know which of those four buttons are which ones. You know, the bottom left is the audio or is the back button.
Is the back button. The top left is the navigation. The one on the right bottom, I think, is home.
Yeah.
And the one on the top right is audio.
Right. So once you get used to those,
and that's from memory.
You can, like, yeah. I mean, you can do that without looking at it, you know, and just glance over at the screen, you know, and manipulate the stuff fairly quickly. And that's the thing I like about those rotary control systems is that you can do that, you know, without it. Once you remember where the button positions are, it takes less cognitive load than actually aiming for a touch target on the screen.
I knew you were going to get that in there somewhere. Well, I think as with any infotainment system, it's always a matter of getting used to it. And, you know, I did know, you know, I took the time to load in favorites so that I didn't have to go through that motions of trying to, you know, when I went to change the music and stuff. But it's, again, as anything, you have to spend the time with the infotainment system to maximize it and to get used to it. There are others, though, that I think are a little bit more intuitive to use. And so that would be my only thing. But it's not something that I got used to it after a while. And again, it's none of these things are reasons not to buy this vehicle. It's such a good small car that I would absolutely tell people to put it on their shopping list.
Yeah,
because there's so many good things about it.
I was going to say, like, okay, we've given plenty of oversight on sort of the stuff that's a little bit, you know, that you should see that you can live with. But overall, the reasons to buy the vehicle are, like, you know, it looks great. It's pretty comfortable, right? It seems luxurious.
It's quiet. It's steady. I love the fact that it has all-wheel drive to it. It doesn't feel like an Econobox at all. I mean, for under $30,000, you know, and again, this one is all dolled up, so you can definitely get them for less. And so, you know, for under $30,000, I think that's it's a really, really good vehicle. It's something that you don't necessarily need to have absolutely everything in it. So, I think it's something that everybody can get used to. You know, all the stuff that we're talking about is addressable in many ways. But, you know, I'm also not going to just sit there and be a fangirl and say, this is the perfect vehicle. You know, I'm going to address what some of the concerns that I had. But, you know, it's got a 2.5 liter four cylinder engine that was really peppy. The only thing I didn't like when I put it in sport mode, I just found it made the engine rev louder and noisier, and I didn't find it appealing.
Okay.
I can agree with that.
Yes. So that, you know, it didn't seem to really do much for me. So I kept it just in general. I didn't put it in, I put it in sport several times trying to like it. it didn't.
Yeah.
It wasn't for me. Overall, it's great.
Sport can be like that in a lot of cars. It can just be like,
yeah.
That.
Yeah.
All right. Well, now that we've had a thorough winding thesis on all things small car. Oh, how's the trunk? Is the trunk decent?
The trunk is pretty good, actually. Yeah, no, the trunk is really good. I had to, we're clearing out my mom's house. And so I had some electronics and stuff to bring to Goodwill. And it was super easy. And, you know, it had a good amount of space to it, for sure. The only thing that was annoying, and this is probably a setting, when you unlock all the doors, the trunk does not unlock as well. So the number of times that I walked up to the unlocked car thinking the trunk would unlock as well was annoying. And so that again is probably just a setting on there, but the size of the trunk itself was great.
Yeah.
And if it's not quite enough for you, then opt for the hatchback, which, you know, as always, you know, has more utility than any, especially in small cars, has more utility than sedans.
Yeah. And I think the hatchback is a fantastic option, you know, for those people that don't want to have an SUV. Be all over that hatch. I think it's really cool. And while we're on the topic of Mazda, I think we're driving the CX-30, the 2020 CX-30 in a couple of weeks in California.
Yep. I'll be there on the first wave.
All right, so we'll be looking forward to that.
So you can tell us about the infotainment and the seating position and the visibility, whether it measures up to this car, because it's basically like a crossover version of this car, right?
It is. Yeah. I actually spent some time this week at the LA Auto Show talking with the program manager for the CX-30. And, you know, we talk and we can get into that a little more next time after Rebecca and I have had a chance to drive it. But, you know, it's it is, you know, very heavily derived from the CX-3.
Excellent. That bodes well.
From the three. I mean, not the CX-3, yeah. Just the three.
Yeah, because the interior, you know, the interior on this vehicle is really, really nice. And the switches, the toggles, all that had a really, really nice feel to it. The leather dash was beautiful. Nice top stitching. Like there's just really nice premium features. I will say that it had a USB in the front and a wireless charging pad. But then in the back, I was a little surprised there aren't any USBs in the center console in the back. Again, it's a five seat car that you probably don't have a lot of people in the back, but it was a lot of cars have that now. So I was a little surprised that it didn't have that. That would be a nice add in the future.
Yeah. And hey, they got to save money somewhere, right? If you want the USBs. Yes. All right. So let's stay with Mazda, Sam, because you're driving the 2019 Mazda 6 Signature.
Yeah. So pretty much everything that most of what we just said about the 3 really applies to the Mazda 6 as well.
Then we're done.
You know, in a slightly larger package. It's great styling, really nice interior. It feels very premium. It is one of my favorite midsize sedans, midsize mainstream sedans. The Signature, was new for 2019. We actually talked about it. I drove it earlier this year and we talked about it then. So I'm not going to, repeat too much of that. But the Signature comes with the turbocharged version of the 2.5 liter that has 227 horsepower and 310 foot-pounds of torque. It's front wheel drive only, no all wheel drive, but it does have, most of what, the other stuff that you will find on the 3. That extra rear seat leg room, a little bit more headroom in the back, slightly bigger trunk. But, aside from that, it's the same kind of feel that you get in a three, just extended and expanded, you know. And I had the chance last year to drive one of these during the Mama Spring Rally at Road America, you know, where you get to really thrash it. And, you know, I mean, for a front wheel drive, you know, midsize sedan, you know, I mean, this thing has some fantastic driving dynamics. It feels really good, you know. And in this case, you know, with the sport mode, you know, you do get a little bit more because it is a more powerful engine. You do, you know, get a little bit more of that feel. It's not just, you know, holding the gears longer and revving higher before it shifts and making more noise. You know, it actually, you know, has some extra performance that you get from that. But overall, you know, the same kinds of themes that you get, you know, from any Mazda car, any modern Mazda car are there. And, you know, you get a lot of, you know, the same kind of equipment with, you know, the driver assist features. The lane keeping assist that Mazda has on the 6 is not great. It's not particularly effective. You know, it's fine as more as a lane departure warning system. It doesn't really do much to really try to intervene to actually keep you in the lane. It's certainly not a lane centering system, but the adaptive cruise control works well. The blind spot monitoring is all there. You know, you have really nice Napa leather covered seats. And it's just, you know, it's just a really lovely place to spend time. You know, if you've got to do a lot of driving, you know, this is a great vehicle to do it in.
What's the price point on it?
This one, you know, this is the loaded one. It has everything, you know, basically you can't add anything else to this, you know, including delivery charge. It came to $36,520.
Oh, that's not bad.
Yeah, I mean, you know, compared to, you know, a loaded Camry or Accord or even a Fusion, you know, it's in that same ballpark. They're all in that mid-30s price range. So, you know, it's not cheap, but it's, you know, you can certainly get, you know, a Mazda 6 in one of the lower trim levels, you know, in the mid-20,000s range.
Right.
You know, it's you know, you're not going to get the Napa leather seats and the turbo engine. But, you know, aside from that, you know, most of the rest of the basic characteristics of this, even in base trim levels, you know, Mazda, you know, really does a great job with their interiors. And, you know, it's just a great place to spend time. You know, it feels much more premium than its price point would suggest.
That's the Mazda trick. And it looks great too. You know, the 6 especially is elegant.
Yeah,
you know,
it's a fantastic looking car. Yeah,
the bit of length lets them sort of stretch out the lines. You know, the 3 looks great, but the 6 really, because it's a little longer, it really, the styling develops a little better. And they're just beautiful.
Right. And the 6, you know, the 6 is nearing the end of its current life cycle. Mm. You know, so it still has the kind of the earlier iteration of Mazda's Kodo design theme. So you've got, you know, a little more sharper creases, you know, compared to what you see on the 3. The 3, they've kind of softened it. You know, the theme that they talked about last year when they first showed the 3, you know, was this idea of, you know, a pebble, you know, in a stream, you know, the water's been running over for many years and smoothing it out. So taking, you know, kind of those same kinds of themes and evolving it further. And I'll be really fascinated to see what they do with the next generation 6, you know, as they bring this updated version of this design language to that car and apply what they've done with the 3, you know, to that slightly larger form factor.
Well, we've covered Mazda pretty comprehensively now. I mean, I think it's like most of their lineup.
Yeah. Well, actually, not so much anymore. I mean, you know, they're now going to be up to 4 SUVs with the addition of the CX-30. And, you know, the CX-5 already accounts for more than half of all Mazda sales in the U.S.
Yeah, that's a good one, too. I like that a lot.
Yeah, that is. Yeah. I do wonder, you know, how successful they've been trying to sort of move up scale. I mean, I like the fact that they're speaking with the product first. But, you know, consideration and such, you know, continues to, I think, be an ongoing challenge. But the product certainly is there and really nice.
Yeah, I think I would say that, you know, there may be reconsidering the pace at which they try to move up scale. Mm. You know, when you look at the pricing, that, you know, one of the things this week at the LA Auto Show, they announced the U.S. pricing for the CX-30, which starts at about $23,000.
Oh, they've got 21.9. on the site.
Well, with delivery. Just on a slight tangent here, I think it's time for all manufacturers to just stop calling out the MSRP without delivery. If you cannot take the option to take delivery somewhere where you don't have to pay for it, just include it in the MSRP, because it's not an optional extra.
Right.
It is something you absolutely, it's a mandatory fee that you must pay. So just include it.
You mean you can't go to Hiroshima and get your Mazda for no delivery?
Sadly, you cannot. So 23,000 including delivery, which, for a compact crossover like that is actually, not an unreasonable price, especially, when you consider that it, like other Mazdas, it does have, a more premium feeling interior than much of its competitive class. And so, I think that they are, at least with the CX-30, they're trying to, and I think, with the 3 as well, I think they tried to hold the line on pricing, try to give it that premium feel, but not go overboard on the pricing, because the all-wheel drive sedan that you drove, Rebecca, $31,000, is not bad. That's a perfectly reasonable price, I think, for what you're getting.
Right. For the content and the quality and the capability, I agree with you. It's still a lot. We don't want to dismiss that, but for what you're getting, there's a good value story there. Now, when I'm looking at the Mazda site, one of the things, and when we're going on a low grade rant about manufacturers, I'm curious because, there seems to be a lot of 20, like on the Mazda site, the Mazda CX-3 and the Mazda CX-5, you can still build a 2018 on their site and then 2019. And they don't have, some cars have 2020, but not others. But there's three different model years on their website.
We've got inventory to move.
I find this is fascinating. Well, it's almost 2020.
It's not unusual, on most manufacturers' websites, you'll usually find a link to previous model years, where you can build at least the 1 year earlier model, because they often do still have some inventory in stock. And the other thing I've been noticing, especially in the past year, is many of these manufacturers are, the 2020, or the new model years, the new model year models are actually coming in many cases, not, in some cases they're coming earlier, in some cases they're actually coming later. The 2020, Nissan Sentra, was just launched. It's almost the end of November now. They just launched it this week in LA, and it'll be going on sale early in the year.
Right.
And in the past, typically anything that went on sale after the 1st of January usually took up the next model year. But now that's often not the case. They're often starting, with the, even if it's in the middle of the model year like that, they're starting with the current model year.
Do we know why that's happening? I mean, did certification change or something? Like, it's just something that's really curious to me.
I'm not really sure. I haven't really delved into it much. I don't think there's any real certification changes. In a lot of cases, it's just kind of arbitrary decision making.
Well, I think it was brought to my attention when I was doing this project that I was embroiled in the last couple of weeks, where I was looking at literally 80 different models, and it just struck me that how many 2019s I was still writing about, because that's what was available on the website. And then as we're talking about Mazda this morning, I'm just looking at that. So anyway, it's just an observation.
it's funny, this is actually this kind of move away to some degree from the traditional model year designations is actually something that was kind of started by Tesla. Because Tesla has never really stuck with the usual model year designations. They do it for EPA certification purposes. That's something that's required.
Right.
But beyond that, in their marketing, their advertising, on their website, you'll never see model year designations. It's just whatever they happen to be building at that particular moment. And they don't hold off until a new model year to introduce new stuff. They will roll out changes whenever they feel like it's ready. Whether it's actually ready or not is another story, but they roll out changes, on the fly. And so the model year designations don't mean as much there. And traditional manufacturers haven't gone to that degree, but they are being a little more fluid in what, you know, what a given model year, you know, when a given model year starts or finishes.
We'll speak and we'll circle back to Tesla. But Dan, what are you driving?
Yeah. And so I had the 2020 GMC Sierra AT4 with the Carbon Pro package and the off-road performance package or some stuff. Anyway, it was a $67,000 $1,500, which seems like a lot of money for a $1,500, but I understand that people are spending lots on pickups. And I really want to know why people seem to think that the GMC and Chevrolet pickups are not as good as, say, the Ram and the Ford pickups, because those two seem to be really gunning for number one. Number one, obviously, is Ford in terms of overall sales, although there's an argument to be made there. But also, Ram seems to be duking it out with GMC for
Chevrolet
for the number two slot. And I can understand some of the criticism, but this is a really good pickup truck.
Yeah.
But did you borrow a front end loader and drop a load of cinder blocks into the bed to see if it would scratch the carbon fiber bed?
No, I did not.
Then you didn't really test it.
Right. I will say that in terms of doing truck stuff, I did very little truck stuff. But because this is a very tarted up $67,000 $1,500 with red tow hooks and all the goodies and stuff, I probably drove it the way I see most of these very fancy 1500s being used, which is not to do truck stuff. And it's right. Basically as a commuter car. And in that respect, it is just, it's a lovely truck to drive. What I liked about it was that it drives like all the teams spoke to each other on a regular basis.
Like, yeah, well, it does.
I can't remember. Did you say this was a Denali?
No, it's the AT4. So it's the mid-level trim. The 6.2 liter V8, though, which and the 10-speed auto, which I think is probably one of the biggest reasons to like it.
Did it have the multi-pro tailgate?
Yes, it did.
Good.
And so first of all, small blocks are lovely. This is the loveliest example of a small block. Like one of the things I've always loved about small blocks is that just sort of like wave of sort of competent, quiet torque that you always get. Even the ones that were choked by emissions stuff and had like 10 horsepower, they always had this sort of like you could waft along on the right?
They never got below 100 horsepower.
Never below 100. Excellent. All eight cylinders and... 300
well, actually, inches. they never got below 100 horsepower from the factory. For a time, they did, after a while, get below 100 horsepower in the real world because they had a problem with the heat treating on the camshafts.
Yeah, they'd wipe the cams. Yeah,
we had an 82 Malibu with the 4.4 liter V8.
Oh, you had the 260. The smallest. Excellent.
Yeah, and after a while, it started running really bad. Mm. And, you know, I pulled the spark plugs and I was checking compression and I realized that the four middle cylinders weren't doing anything. And I found out that the way they treat the camshafts, the way they heat treat the camshafts, they would bring the heat treat probes in from the ends and spin it up and heat it. And it didn't always get completely hot in the middle, so they were soft. And so the cam lobes would eventually wear off.
They were.
And so I pulled the cam out of this thing, and the four center lobes were completely round.
Circles.
There was no lobes at all.
So you had a half-made camshaft, literally.
Yeah. Well, I had cylinder deactivation before it was popular.
Yeah, that's true.
It was just permanent.
Well, you know, and see, that's an opportunity for an upgrade. Get yourself a nice like high lift cam with make it idle crappy. But no, this V8 and 10 speed transmission work so well together. They're so strong and competent. And I drove gently just to see what I could get out of it. And gently doesn't mean like being a traffic hazard. It means sort of limiting it to like, you know, 65 on the highway and stuff. I got it up to 20 miles per gallon combined, which I was pretty impressed with.
Did you say this was the 5.3 or the 6.2?
6.2.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's good, man.
It has stop start. You know, you spend more time in stop and go traffic. Obviously, your average drops. But if you drive it sort of in a relaxed fashion, it returns pretty decent fuel economy. And it's a good truck for driving in that relaxed fashion because it tends to just reward you. It all the controls feel really good. You know, the steering, the brakes, the accelerator, everything works together. You know, one of the things I don't like about the Fords is they've got that real squishy EcoBoost throttle response where it's you get that real strong hit of turbo torque and you're constantly like making adjustments where this one seems a lot more linear because it's not a turbocharged engine and it works really well with its 10 speed auto. So it was just great to drive from a driving perspective. It drove really well and it was quiet and it rode pretty well. So the thing it's 2/3 of a Tahoe. So I was like, or 2/3 of a Suburban really. And I was like, well, I could be down with this or, and GMC, I guess it's Yukon. So, I liked all that. I liked a lot of the thoughtful touches around the interior. The infotainment was decent. You know, the controls were good, except for, you know, some of the climate controls were a little crappy where they were sort of, they gang functions on a button. But other than that, you know, it was just a really easy truck to operate and to use and very, very good to drive. And I feel like if you were to load it up with a trailer and, you know, take a long haul with it, great. The off-road stuff kind of is a little confusing here. Because all it really does is it adds tires, it makes some noise and limit your traction. So your braking distance gets longer, your cornering gets a little bit worse, and your steering accuracy is not as good. And it's just such a long truck. I guess it can go off-road, but I feel like it's probably going to be out of its element a lot sooner than something like a Raptor or the Ram. What's the Ram? The Power?
The Rebel.
No, the Rebel, yeah. And you know, those two are probably a little bit more equipped, although it does have a suspension lift with the off-road package. It seemed maybe less in character. But again, you know, not taking it off-road, I'm sure that stuff probably helps, but my fear is always like, yeah, it'll help me get stuck like deeper in the woods. So it's a more expensive tow.
Actually, you'd be surprised how good some of these big trucks are. As long as wherever you're going, you know, has enough width for the truck to fit through, these things are surprisingly capable off-road. I mean, I haven't driven the Sierra off-road, but you know, I've driven the Rebel and the and in the past, you know, some of the Fords on off-road courses, and they can actually handle a surprising amount. You know, granted, you know, compared to, you know, a two-door Wrangler, you know, you're not going to have the same kind of breakover height you would with those, you know, and certainly, you know, again, as I said, the width is going to be a limiting factor, but overall, you know, these things can go pretty much anywhere.
Huh? I mean, I guess that's fair. So this is where I walk away kind of puzzled because I thought that it's a really nice package, and yes, it's expensive, but the what makes it really nice is the basic goodness of the truck. So you don't have to buy the fancy Sierra to get a pretty decent truck. And it, you know, the sort of most lasting impression was how light on its feet it felt, where the Ram feels just like you're driving the Titanic. It just feels so heavy. And it is.
Yeah, I think the GM products tend to drive smaller than they are. There's just something they've done a really good job on that aspect of it. And you don't feel like you're hauling a truck around with you.
Yeah.
And, you know, for some of the moaning that, you know, that people have done about, you know, perhaps the quality, especially on the Silverado, maybe less so on the Sierra, but the quality of the interior materials, things like that. You know, one thing that GM has done a really good job at over the last 6 or 7 years is reducing the weight of their vehicles. You know, they've done a lot of work. Yeah, and that's without, you know, taking the Ford path of resorting to an all aluminum body. You know, they've done some very smart use of mixed material architectures, you know, using various grades of steels and aluminums and in the case of this particular truck, carbon fiber. Yep. For the bed. You know, it's GM's done a lot of great stuff there. you know, to actually make it lighter. So not only does it feel like it's driving lighter, it actually is lighter than the other trucks.
Yeah, and that pays off.
Not so much lighter than the Ford. It's close to the same weight as the Ford, even without using all aluminum.
Right, and that was the joke, right? Was that the Ford had to go to aluminum to get it as light as the Chevy.
but it
really, like, that pays off. The Ford F-Series feels kind of like loose fit, and just that's not a truck I like. The interior, and those trucks are cheap too. The interior here was a little harder to get a read on, and I tried to really examine materials. It probably is the area where it doesn't compare as well to Ram, which is they're the class leader. They have the nicest cabins. This is all black, so I think that hides some of the contrast in materials quality. It had leather for the seats with some highlight trim on it. But the lower dash and parts of the door panels probably aren't as nice as you're going to find in Ram. I think it's competitive in the class, though. And if you want to get picky about it for your $67,000, it probably feels more like a $40,000 interior. But again, that's the same kind of thing you get in the Fords, even with their super duper trim that goes way, way, way up above $70,000.
Well, and you always have to balance the work truck aspect of this, because you don't want somebody to come in and say, I can't use this truck for work because it's too nice.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, so that I agree, the materials are, there's always that you need to have a certain amount of durability to these materials because it's still, at the end of the day, is a pickup truck.
Yeah. And you know, styling wise, I think it's very handsome. So it surprised me, because I came at it like, well, these are the trucks that everybody's saying are not as good. They're the trucks that are lagging the competition. I don't think that's true. I think the F-Series sort of claims its sales crown through a variety of sleight of hand. It's a very competitive market. All the trucks are good. These don't feel any less solid. Trucks,
the volume is split between the GMC and Chevy
right.
brands. And so that's always one of the arguments.
Right. And, you know, in the past, there have been times when the combined sales of GMC and Chevrolet actually did exceed Ford. But that's not true today.
Yeah, and Ford also has the benefit of they really, really know the fleet business. They have that. They're good at that. If they need to sell a few, they'll sell a few to maintain that position. And they're really good at what they do. And the F-Series is a good truck. None of the trucks are bad. You know, like I said, they all feel solid. Your eyes glaze over when you read the description of the frame. You're like, yeah. Whatever, it's a railroad bridge. Who cares?
But the other thing I'm wondering with the volume, you know, Ram is very clever because they still have the Classic available, and there's an estimate of like 30% of their sales are that Classic, and so, but they don't separate it out; it's all one volume number. Yeah.
And oh boy, I bet they're willing to deal on that.
Oh yeah. Well, those sell primarily, you know, as with Ford, you know, they sell primarily the Classics to fleets and commercial customers.
Yeah, and again,
it's like, got a bench seat, which I think is awesome.
They're not none of this is all down to personal preference. None of these trucks are inherently bad. I prefer the 6.2 here to the turbocharged V6 in the Ford, but again, I think you're paying a premium for that engine. And B, I...
For the V6 or the V8?
For the V8.
Not necessarily.
The 6.2, you know, anyway. I just think at a certain point, the Ford is like... The EcoBoost is going to out-tow. And out, like, it just that the turbos really do help you when it comes to work. They're also going to be thirsty as a bastard, though. Like, you feel it kind of
Go, you know, the thing about the towing, you know, you'll see these three companies, you know, go back and forth, you know, on their claims on who has the highest tow rating, you know. And, you know, the reality is, you know, if you can tow 11,500 pounds or 12,000 pounds or 12,200 pounds, does it really make that much difference?
No, you don't want to tow one of these things out at the edge of their capabilities.
It's a pissing contest between the three of them. You know,
But the, you know, the 6.2 has 420 horsepower. It can tow up to 9,400 pounds. They say that actually it gets 20 miles per gallon on the highway. So I can confirm that on the highway, you can achieve 20 miles per gallon. And it starts at 50,000. So 50,000 plus 7,000 of options actually seems like not that abusive for the the truck buyer. Seems like a pretty solid deal. And it was a good place to spend time. I liked it quite a bit. You know, if we're talking just the what is it, the sybaritic qualities of the truck. It's just a nice luxury
car.
So if you're a sybarite, I think it's a David E. Davis word. But it's just it basically figures. Like the luxurious environment. The more
it's a lovely truck,
more luxurious it is, the more super. I like GMC's approach and like GM's approach, you know, instead of having like sort of like fold down steps on the side of the bumper, they just cut a hole in it and stuck a step in there.
Yeah, they just mold it right into the bumper itself.
Yeah, it seems like there's a lot of those little thoughts that are like, okay, we could just do it this way, which is a little bit more, and every truck manufacturer is going to have their own little bit of clever. So
speaking of those little thoughts, did you actually try playing around with that multi-pro tailgate?
I did a bit.
Whatever it is they call it.
It was a little, I was a little confused by it. Just like what, like this, okay, this one goes down. This one goes like just the different configurations. It's like a Swiss Army knife. You know, you fold out all the blades and you're like, what am I going to do with it?
I think there's six different positions you can use.
Yeah. They need to put like well, I'm sure there's a guide in the glove compartment, which
I think
cool, you know,
one of the issues I've seen with it is in some cases, you know, if you actually have a trailer hooked up, it, you know, can interfere with the trailer, you know, if you drop down like
the step
part of it, the middle section of it, you know, it'll hit the trailer hitch. So you have to be careful of things like that. But, you know, I mean, otherwise, I think it's generally a good idea. Of course, it does add complexity and cost to the thing.
But you don't have to buy it.
No, you don't. So, but, you know, I mean, it's part of that, you know, $11,000 or almost $12,000 Carbon Pro package on the AT4 that also includes the carbon fiber bed. And you know, it's interesting that they don't break out the cost of that carbon fiber bed. I'd be curious to know how much that by itself costs.
Do you think that carbon fiber bed is significantly more expensive than, well, yeah, I guess it is significantly more expensive than a stamped steel bed.
It's way more expensive than a stamped steel bed. It saves about 70 pounds. I think it was 69 pounds or something that they said. And, you know, of course, it's never going to rust. And they've done some interesting manufacturing techniques with that. You know, it's actually made in the same way as they do sheet molding compound body panels for Corvettes, the SMC body panels. So it's not done in the traditional layup approach that has been done for carbon fiber in the past.
Is it claved? So like, do they do it under pressure?
No, it's not.
Huh. Interesting.
So it's, yeah. So that brings the cost down substantially. And this is the first, you know, high volume application, or, you know, comparatively high volume application of this kind of technology for carbon fiber.
See, I think that's going to be one of those features that everybody sort of, you know, like when we had plastic valve covers and intakes and stuff come out, you know, everybody thought it was going to be a failure point, and I think it's not going to be. You know, there may be some teething pains, but composites are materials that automakers have been using for a very long time, and they'll figure it out, and it will be a benefit. You know, who wants a pickup truck with a bed that rusts out? And that is a significant problem. So I think too, it's worth whatever the extra cost is to GM. When you consider you can save 60 pounds there and put it elsewhere in the truck, like that's completely worth it.
Or add it right onto your payload rating.
Yeah. Either or. So that seems like a pretty good win to me.
Did yours have moving running boards?
No. I'm getting confused between that and the vehicle I've got this week.
I'm pretty sure this is the truck that has the running boards actually will move backwards, and which allows you to get into the truck bed that way as well.
Oh, from the front. Oh, that's slick.
Right. It's really, really cool. Yeah, it's really cool.
I hadn't noticed that before.
Huh. Yeah, it's just a slight movement back, and then you can get then into the truck. Because, of course, egress and ingress is always my issue.
Yeah.
Well, and particularly, you know, with this truck, you know, one of the things when GM launched the new Sierra and Silverado last year, one of the things they talked about is that the bed sides are higher on this one compared to the previous generation, compared to most others. So you actually have more contained volume in the bed because they raised the sides of the bed by, I don't know, 3 or 4 inches, something like that. You know, which also, you know, if you're coming in from the side, you know, does make reaching in to grab stuff a little more challenging, no matter how tall you are.
Yeah.
Right. It does. So this is the other thing, too. And I apologize if you hear Lucy in the background because she has decided to join us.
Hi, Lucy.
So getting in and out of the new Ram 1500 without the split tailgate, the only way that you can access that bed is through the license plate holder. It's outrageous.
Yeah.
It was just something that was so mind-boggling to me that they have not made more advancements
there. They do offer an optional retracting step on the rear that you can put your foot on it, push it down, and let you get up in there.
I saw that with the split tailgate because I actually demonstrated that on Fox Business and Fox and Friends or something for them. So I used that to get in and out, but that was with the split tailgate. Does it come even without the split tailgate?
You can get it with the conventional tailgate as well.
All right. The version, the 1500 that I had last year, I remember having it around Christmas time. It did not have it. And I complained bitterly to my friends there. And they were like, no, it's coming. So then went the Chicago Auto Show when they showed the split tailgate. Then that was one of the reasons I demonstrated it, was because I was happy that they finally did something.
I think we all benefit from the truck wars here. They're all good. It just comes down to which one you like.
It does. And it pushes them to innovate, and, you know, which I think is a good segue to talking about innovative pickup trucks.
I don't know what you could have in mind.
So, shall I introduce our next topic?
Well, I think
we must.
Our comment right before we recorded, I think, is sort of the most salient point here, is that with one sort of amateur hour press conference and a vehicle that seems rather slapped together, they were able to erase a week of coverage from
the
LA Auto Show.
Tesla. Yes. Just to be clear.
Yes. So go ahead. I thought that was amazing.
Well, no, I just wanted to clarify who they were, because we haven't actually verbalized it yet.
Yeah. Well,
the Tesla press conference showing their Cybertruck. I think that was one of the more jaw dropping, inexplicable, this has to be a joke moments that we've all had in a long time.
It was not what I was expecting. What did you think, Sam?
Well, let me just say, first of all, that, you know, taste when it comes to design is a very personal matter.
Okay.
You know, and there's no guarantee that any two people will have the same taste in the way things look or should look. And frankly, I think this thing looks absolutely ridiculous. I know there are those out there like Tim Stevens at CNET that disagree with me and think it's a very innovative design and, you know, should give Tesla credit for that. That's fine.
I disagree strongly.
I would not want to be seen anywhere near this thing.
Design aside, because it's okay to look weird. I'm fine with that. Like, make the Lamborghini Countach of trucks all you want. But I've seen weird takes on it. Like, it's going to be cheaper to manufacture because it has flat stainless steel body panels. I don't think so. First of all, I think once you get to
stainless
that
stainless steel is more expensive than regular steel or aluminum. So, you know, I don't think that that's going to be true.
Right. And you don't ever want to be putting dead flat body panels on a vehicle. They have much less inherent rigidity because there's no radius. The stamping them out to a radius gives them some some stiffness that's not there if you just use a flat panel that's just going to flap around. Like, there's just a whole host of reasons why that just doesn't ring true to me.
But they demonstrated this to us that's not true for this one. It's as stiff as anything.
Yeah.
Franz von Holzhausen, took a sledgehammer to the side and couldn't dent it.
It was a dead blow hammer. And that's just showmanship. Fine. And there's always spectacle to any car introduction. So like those things that people are saying, well, it's not street legal. Yes, I get it. It doesn't look like it's been designed with that in mind. It's a concept car. And every automaker introduces concept cars that have various non-street legal aspects. So I get it. I don't want to, I think that's not where we should put our energy right now. What I see is a fundamental problem with the Tesla Cybertruck is that they don't seem to have spent any time trying to understand the truck market, the needs of the truck buyer. Like we were just talking about all of these things, right, with this GMC truck, where the stuff that makes it work when you're doing work. This seems like a Model S truck, and it seems like the Model S buyer is the person they're speaking to, not anybody who has maybe a fleet of 100 trucks for their business that might be looking to go EV. And it doesn't seem like they've thought about those needs or fleet service. I certainly wouldn't want to invest in even two of these and try to keep them up and running for fleet use with Tesla's track record of initial quality and service and support. Like that seems like you're going to be buying another truck just so you can get to work. So I'll back off and just see what your impressions are. Either of you have any particular takes you'd like to share?
Why don't you go first, Rebecca?
Okay. I think there's a couple things. You're absolutely right, Dan. I don't think that they've considered who buys pickup trucks. And they often... Tesla will refer to the millions of units that are sold every year. But as you say, we've just gone through that there is always that balance of beauty and functionality and utility, probably more so than any other vehicle. The reason that people purchase this, purchase a pickup truck is for the most part to utilize its functionality. I do think that the bed was really cool with the built-in ramp. The ATV was the best part of that show.
And it was the Yamaha.
Which apparently may not have even been a Tesla built ATV. It looks, the reports online are that it looks like it was based on an existing Yamaha ATV.
And probably just spray painted black or something.
Yeah.
But, I think that, again, like trying to be somewhat objective, looking at what I did like about it, I thought that was a really cool feature to have the built in ramp. I don't think that it's a functional truck. When the bed is covered, it looks like it covers the rear windscreen, and having just talked about visibility, I think there's a lot of compromised visibility. I know that there's the camera, the rear view camera that many vehicles have today, particularly GM.
Mandatory now.
The rear view mirror that turns into a camera. I don't know what there's a fancy name for that, but
a camera mirror system.
The GMC Sierra. It was the first time that I had ever seen that, and I found it to be super easy to use, but it was weird to not see the occupants of your vehicle then. And my understanding is that they don't have a toggle back for that. So you've got people in the back seat. You're not going
to... That's something that we'll have to change, because legally you have to have a reflective mirror as well.
Okay.
So that's why all the ones that are out there now, the various GM models and some others now as well, they can all toggle between the reflective mirror and the camera display.
Well, and they should all toggle between that.
You're right, because you want that as a backup, in case something goes wrong with the camera.
Well, and it's also just the idea that sometimes it is helpful to be able to see, to glance back and see people that are in the vehicle with you. So obviously, you know, there's a lot of, you know, there's no side mirrors and, you know, the camera system. I drove the Audi e-tron last December overseas, we had the cameras, the side mirrors were cameras, which definitely took a little time to get used to, but eventually we did, you know, through the course of the day. So all these things you can overcome. I do like the fact that it has, you know, the leveling suspension and such. We saw that again when they reloaded the ATV, that front end came up high. I mean, that thing was high, and then it sort of, you know, it self-leveled. So all those things are good. It's just that, you know, I think that you do have to have a fundamental understanding of the consumer that buys pickup trucks. And, you know, I can't see a rancher or somebody that uses this as a pickup truck, a contractor, using this as a pickup truck. It's not to say they're not going to buy them, but they wouldn't, they're not going to, this isn't going to be a work truck.
Who do you think is going to be attracted to it?
It's not attraction. It's not about the design, right? The design is very, very controversial, no doubt. But I can see, and God bless them, I can see contractors here in Greenwich pulling up to that thing.
Really?
With that thing. Because it's a talking point, right? And it shows how innovative they are. And
you'll see the owner of the company.
Yes, exactly. Not the
electricians and the plumbers.
Exactly.
And
not the trade.
The guy that owns the company.
Right. The guy that owns the company. And keep in mind too, you know, we went through this period of brutalist architecture. And, you know, look at Boston Town Hall, for God's sakes. It's considered one of the ugliest buildings in the world.
City Hall Plaza is so good. If you looked at the other proposals, they definitely picked the best one.
Well, that's a low bar.
The FBI, the Hoover Building in Washington, D.C., also brutalist architecture.
No,
this is a brutalist car. That's how it's designed.
Yeah. I appreciate brutalist architecture, you know, corduroy concrete, and you make the materials part of the design in a very, you know, sort of deliberate way. In terms of the concerns that you would have for a truck, the packaging seems to really suffer in this design, because like that high peaked roof, you've got no rear headroom. You know, practically, when, you know, part of the trick of designing anything is to fit around your actual functional parameters, right? Like if you're designing a truck, you've got to start with like, what is it going to be doing?
And you design from the inside out, not from the outside in.
Right. And there's always that friction between engineering and design, and nobody's going to get exactly what they want. But really, the magic happens when they come together and everybody's satisfied with the compromises made in the end product. They talked a little bit about some of the capabilities, and, you know, the towing numbers seem good. My concern is that there was emphasis put on the acceleration numbers, which are complete nonsense. There are some people that care how quickly their trucks get to 60 miles an hour. I really don't think that's an issue. I think really what makes more sense is to talk about what, if any, modifications have been made to the power hardware, you know, the batteries, the cabling, the motors, how much it can tow, how long it can do it for, you know, because we don't really have a good idea of how to measure that. Like, how long are you going to get useful work out of this electric truck? We haven't really been there yet, so we don't really know what the best way to measure that is. And they could have established that and saying like, this is useful to you because, you know, we limited the performance in terms of speed, but certainly more than adequate performance, and you get X amount of range even while you're towing 10,000 pounds or something. And you know, I'm still, Tesla has good power electronics, good batteries, good motors, but when you're trying to start off an extra 10,000 pounds on that, you know, you're going to put a lot of current demands on everything, and current equals heat. And, you know, how have they done all that? I didn't get any of that.
Yeah, you know, to what you said about, you know, acceleration, for example, the truck that they showed was on these big knobbly off-road tires. Yeah. And, you know, if you try to accelerate to 60 in 2.9 seconds on those tires, you're going to get, you know, one, maybe two launches off those tires before you start shredding them. Yeah. You know, so that's, you know, you can either have the off-road capability or you can have that kind of acceleration, but not both. You know, similarly with the towing, you know, it used to be up until about 2011, 2012 timeframe, you know, when you heard tow ratings from manufacturers, you know, from Ford and GM and Chrysler and anybody else, you know, they tended to be all over the map because there was no standard for towing. You know, SAE developed a standard testing procedure for doing tow ratings, just as they'd have in the past with horsepower and torque and all kinds of other things. That's one of the things that SAE, the Society of Automotive Engineers, does. They develop standards that most of the industry adheres to. And, you know, that J2807 standard, you know, ever since then, you know, manufacturers test to that standard. And so now you can directly compare those tow ratings. My guess is that 14,000 pound tow rating we heard about the other night was not done to the J2807 standard. And, you know, if you talk to Dan Edmonds, we'll have to get him on the show one of these days, from Edmonds.com. No relation to the family that owns Edmonds.com, by the way. But, you know, Dan, you know, does most of their testing. And he's done a lot over the last several years with Teslas, and, you know, has great respect for a lot of what Tesla does, you know, as I do from a technical standpoint. But, you know, like, he's done a lot of tow testing with the Model X, you know, because it has a 5,000 pound tow rating. And, you know, if you look up some of the stuff he's written on it, you know, basically, you know, even with a fairly small trailer hooked up to a Model X, like a less than 2,000 pound trailer, he was losing about, you know, at least half of the range of that vehicle when towing. And, you know, this is one of the challenges when you're towing. You know, you do have a significant degradation in efficiency, whether it's gas efficiency, you know, if you're towing with a conventional truck or range with an EV, you're going to lose a lot when you're towing because you're doing a lot more work. Your aerodynamics are a lot worse. And, you know, this is one of the reasons why, you know, manufacturers, you know, all three of the domestic manufacturers have brought out diesel versions of their light duty trucks. You know, even though they are seen primarily as a niche product, a relatively low volume product in the grand scheme of things, you know, like for Ford, I think they project, you know, sales of the diesel F-150 to be no more than about 30 to 35,000 units a year. For people that tow all the time, like, say, for example, a landscaper, you know, that has to tow around, you know, a bunch of equipment, you know, a bunch of lawnmowers and, you know, all kinds of other equipment that, you know, they are towing on a daily basis. When you're towing with an EcoBoost F-150, you know, that 22, 23 mile per gallon rating that it nominally has, that drops to about 11 or 12 a lot of times. You know, same thing goes for, you know, a lot of the other trucks, even for a V8 truck, you know, you a gas V8, you lose a lot of fuel efficiency when you're towing. And one of the advantages that a diesel engine has is that under load, it actually has much less degradation in fuel efficiency under load. So if you're, you know, they targeted that truck at people that tow all the time, whether you're towing a horse trailer or, you know, a load of lawnmowers, you know, that's something that is an advantage to those customers. And what we've seen so far from Tesla, from the one Tesla vehicle that can tow, the Model X, is that it suffers from that same problem of, you know, basically cutting your efficiency in half or more when you hook up a trailer to it. And, you know, I think that's going to be a real challenge, not just for Tesla, but for all the manufacturers that are bringing out electric pickup trucks in the next couple of years.
Yeah, well, I mean, it takes your range from, so if you have a 300 mile range, now you have 150. And if it's hilly, right, you have less. Well, I mean, yeah, depending on regen and stuff. But it also really stresses all of the powertrain. So, you know, what does the durability of that look like? And I don't know that that's been really comprehensively tested.
Yeah, I guess I'm less concerned about durability of electric trucks in general, as opposed to, you know, maybe in the case of Tesla's trucks, we'll see. You know, they most of Tesla's vehicles, you know, they have more of a problem with reliability than durability. You know, things, you know, randomly stop working. But I think when they do work, you know, they tend to work for a long time. You know, talking, you know, over the last couple of years, a couple of different times to Rahul Sonad, a guy who runs a company called Testloop that until recently offered inner city transportation services with a fleet of Model S's and X's, like between L.A. and San Diego and L.A. and Palm Springs. You know, he's had a couple of Model X's that, you know, racked up over 300,000 miles without too much difficulty. So, you know, in general, an EV shouldn't be too much of a problem there. But, you know, again, you know, we haven't really seen it used in this kind of a use case, you know, with consistent heavy towing. And so that may be putting more load on the batteries than they're really up to, you know, depending on how you do your temperature management in a battery.
Right. And that's, you know, that's my, it makes me scratch my head. I'm not overly concerned about it. It's certainly a solvable problem. I just wonder what it means.
Yeah. But Rebecca, to what you were saying earlier about, you know, the way the truck is designed for, you know, for people, for commercial users, you know, what do you think about commercial users and electric trucks in general, and, you know, more specifically the Cybertruck?
So I love the idea of electric trucks in a fleet environment because they go back to the same station. You know, they go back to a specific charger. You can set up a place where these trucks are going to go back. I also like the, and I'm talking about like UPS, FedEx, the post office. I also like the idea.
Local operations.
I'm
where
sorry?
They're not going long. Local operations where they're not going straight far from home.
Right. We're not talking long haul. We're talking, you know, planned routes. Right. Mm-hmm. And I also like the fact that there you on some level get the neighborhood effect. You know, you get the idea, like, you know, you talk to you're a mailman, you or a mailwoman, you know, you have an electric truck now. You know, what do you think about that? You can kind of get that real world experience. So I think there's, and you also get around the whole, you know, the challenge with the consumer is, you know, is this better than what they have right now? And, you know, when we look at the Tesla truck or any of the other electric vehicles that are coming out, is it better? Does it solve the problem of transportation and mobility and functionality better than what they currently have? And I think that in some cases with that local delivery, it could be, yes, you know, this could be better. When I think too of like what Ford has been able to do with some of their smaller vans, you know, it's been fantastic really, because they were better than what delivery people were using before. So from that standpoint, I'm a fan. When I, you know, from the technology itself, you know, the Cybertruck is incredibly controversial, not because of the design, but because of that limited functionality. You know, again, we've spent some time talking about ingress and egress to the truck bed. Those sides are so high. Is that a functional truck? And that's what, you know, I don't think that they really were able to demonstrate effectively. And, you know, as far as when we think about the design, you know, the way that vehicles are designed historically is because they had an engine in the front for the most part. But, you know, they usually have the engine in the front and you automatically get this long hood. And just because it's not there doesn't mean that you shouldn't design it as if it were, because again, that can be functional space. It doesn't have that frunk. It doesn't have the kind of storage that people need and want in their truck. But in terms of the technology, you know, you're absolutely right, Sam. Tesla, I love the fact that they always push the envelope. They have pushed the traditional automakers to be better, to come out with vehicles that are, you know, that challenge that status quo, that you know, are pushing them. Regulations are doing it as well, but I think that Tesla, with the range that they've been able to achieve, with the historically beautiful vehicles that they've come out with, the stupid Falcon Wing on the Model X doors notwithstanding. But, you know, they push the envelope. The interiors are beautiful. There's there's an elegance to these products that up until the Cybertruck, you know, Tesla was known for. It doesn't have to be ugly. You know, that was always the complaint with the Nissan Leaf and to a lesser extent the Bolt, right, and the Prius. You know, these are not attractive vehicles. Well, that Cybertruck, you know.
To be honest, you know, aside from the Prius, most of those unattractive vehicles didn't sell in huge numbers either. So,
right. Well, and that's what Tesla showed, was that it doesn't have to have, you don't have to have this compromised design language. You can have a beautiful EV. And, you know, as you said at the very beginning, it's in the eye of the beholder. But I do think that most of the Tesla products are really elegant and look, you know, they're distinctive and they turn heads in a positive way. I think the Cybertruck was a big misstep for them and a missed opportunity also. You know, when you see some of the renderings of what it could look like, it was just, you know, I think everyone was kind of waiting for the joke to end and the real truck to come out.
Well, yeah, what I haven't gotten from this is, you know, what's actually underneath it? How is it built and engineered, and what of your existing technology and pieces and parts have you leveraged for this? You know, how did you do any durability testing? You know, all the stuff that a normal automaker will sort of crow about when they introduce a new model. And so Tesla has been successful kind of in spite of its management. You know, all the very hardworking people,
I would say totally in spite of its management,
just want that, you know, they want to succeed. I want them to succeed. What I'm very frustrated by is this just completely haphazard approach to product development and announcements. And, you know, none of their cars really, you know, they haven't built from platform to platform. They like each car is a distinct platform, at least more distinct than it should be. So they're not, you know, they're not gaining efficiencies. This doesn't look like they did any market research on who might buy it. So it like the people that are going to buy this. And I honestly don't think that this truck has much of a chance of ever seeing the light of day. But if it does, the people who are going to buy it, they're going to cannibalize their own sales. These are Model S people who had trucks before, traded them for a Model S, and now want, you know, now there's a product for them. That's great. So they're not going to necessarily see a net increase in sales. There'll be some conquests, but really not too many. I'm frustrated by the squandered potential. There's a lot of opportunity to do better. I want them to do better because they could kill it if they put their sort of their hearts and minds to it. And I'm just not seeing that. This looks like a vanity project that was very poorly considered. So we'll see where it goes. I don't want to belabor the point. But I want to know more about what's under the actual controversial bodywork.
Well, and to, you know, continue on the topic of the idea of an electric pickup truck, just in general, I would love to hear from people and the idea of, you know, do they see this as a potential work truck? You know, Sam, to your point, I had actually been discussing this on Twitter with somebody about landscapers, you know, and the people that have to tow and such. But there are other places that pickup trucks go that aren't necessarily require towing. And so, you know, of course the electric range, it all depends on the charging, right? It all depends on the charging infrastructure and stuff. So, but can we get traditional pickup truck owners, you know, even if you get 1 or 2% of that population, it's still a good number. You know, that is this a technology that pickup truck owners can see eventually integrating into their lifestyle?
I think that, you know, especially for commercial users, I think that there's actually a huge opportunity for electrification in trucks, because, you know, for commercial users, you know, for the average consumer, you know, you tend to drive 12,000, 15,000 miles a year. And as we've talked about before, going electric from a purely economic standpoint, doesn't necessarily make sense, you know, in terms of the fuel savings you're going to get in going electric. The numbers don't necessarily add up. But for commercial users that often, you know, are going driving 75 to 100,000 miles a year in a lot of applications, now the operating costs of using that vehicle make up a much larger proportion of the total cost of ownership. And, you know, if you're going from $2.50, $3 a gallon, or, you know, if you're in California, $4 a gallon for gas to, you know, electricity, you know, at, depending again where you are, anywhere from 10 to 30 cents a kilowatt hour, now all of a sudden, you know, your operating costs potentially get slashed pretty dramatically. And that makes a big difference for commercial users. So, you know, it depends on how much the upfront cost premium is, but it's, you know, that cost premium is has been shrinking and will continue to shrink. So I think that for a lot of commercial users, I think that they're, you know, if they're driving, you know, let's say, you know, 100, 150 miles a day, doing, you know, whatever their application is, it depends a lot on the application. But I think that there's a lot of opportunity there to get some pretty significant cost savings by going to electric. And, you know, there's some things that you can utilize. You know, I mean, one of the things that Musk talked about was the ability to, utilize the battery to power your tools on a job site. And this is something that Ford has talked about with the F-150 hybrid that's coming out next year is, you know, for contractors and, you know, other users that, you know, have to use power tools or charge power tools on a job site where there may not be electricity available. You know, they can use that. You know, today they have to haul along a generator in their truck. So that's one more piece of equipment they're bringing along. With the F-150 hybrid, they'll be able to use the hybrid electric motor as a generator to power their tools. So that, you know, that simplifies it. And that's going to be a more efficient and cleaner system. Even if they have to keep the gas engine running along there, that's going to be more efficient than a typical gas generator that they have to bring along. So I think that there's some significant opportunities for electrification in the commercial market. But to take advantage of that, you really have to have a design that meets the needs of those same users. You know, think a design that they can, you know, most of those users, you know, do various upfitting, you know, they'll put tool racks and various other equipment on their, on the trucks, you know, for whatever it is they're hauling, that makes it easier, you know, for them. And, you know, most of that equipment is standardized. You know, if you look at trucks today, you know, they have slots in the bed to put racks and various things in, tie downs. And, you know, this is something that with the design of the Cybertruck could be a lot more challenging.
No, I think that there's absolutely opportunity in the commercial space. And I love the idea of using the available battery on a job site. I think that's absolutely fantastic. I mean, it reminds me of, you know, being able to use a power wall or a second source when you lose electricity in your house. So I think that that's why, as Dan said, it's frustrating because this could have been really, really good. And I don't think that they respected the opportunity. And that's something that is frustrating. It's not to say that they're not going to fix it or they won't get better. You know, Tesla won't get better in time. But as you say, there's a ton of opportunities here, and so I do think that it's a real space, and it's a real place where I can see a lot more hybrids and a lot more electric vehicles out there in the marketplace.
Oh, it's a huge soon. Potential market. Yeah, I think that it there's is. A lot of, you know, for whatever you might think about folks who you know, the sort of trucking audience, trucking a customer, I think they're ready to go EV when it makes practical sense for them and it doesn't really cost them that much extra and it's reliable. And, you know, I think like Sam was saying, I think that F-150 is going to do great when it goes hybrid and plug-in.
Well, it's a trusted brand,
yeah, absolutely.
Too.
Absolutely.
And you know, those buyers, you know, they'll be able to reuse a lot of the extra equipment, you know, that they use in their trucks today, you know, in that hybrid and then in the electric version as well when it comes out. And on Thursday morning, you know, Mary Barra was talking at a conference in New York. She's the CEO of GM, and she confirmed that, you know, the GM's electric pickup will be out in the second half of 2021. The Ford F-150 electric should be out in roughly the same time frame. Ford is also doing an electric version of the Transit. You know, this was something that came out of their UAW contract.
That's going to be
their third EV,
which is fantastic.
It's going to be an electric Transit, and that's the vehicle that's going to be running on the Rivian platform.
Get like so widely adopted. I mean, think of all the
yes.
the yeah. I mean, Amazon's running. Well, I guess they're running Fiats, but either way, like yeah. So there's a lot to that market that I feel is untapped, and I think that the sort of the legacy or quote unquote old line automakers who have fleets much more figured out are going to be the ones that crack that wide open. And it's actually going to make them money. That's my prediction.
But Silicon Valley tech bros will love the Cybertruck.
Yeah, that's fine. So they can sit in traffic.
If they can find a place to park it.
Well, they'll just park it on top of all the proletarian. Anyway. Moving on. Let's move on before we get too angry.
All right.
So it was LA last week, right? It was the LA Auto Show. That did happen.
Yeah. I was there for a whole week.
How was it?
It was interesting. You know, like a lot of other recent auto shows, there was less big news that came out of it. You know, fewer announcements, you know, than we had heard prior to the show. That came out of it, but there were a few interesting tidbits. You know, one that came out actually right after was Volkswagen in Germany. So it's not actually related to the show, but Volkswagen announced that they are canceling all their internal combustion engine motorsports programs and going all electric with their motorsports programs. And electrification, you know, as we've just talked about, was really, you know, the big theme of LA, as it has been to varying degrees for the last several years. Audi showed off the e-tron Sportback, which is a different styled version essentially of the same vehicle that we've already driven, the wagon SUV type
e-tron
crossover electric.
I love that e-tron. GT. I think it looks awesome.
This is not the GT, this is the Sportback. So the GT is coming next year. They confirmed the production GT will be out by the end of next year. That's the one we saw as a concept last year in LA.
Right, but the one they showed in LA, I think, looks great.
Right. So the GT is based on the Taycan. The Sportback is based on the e-tron Quattro that we already have, but you know, with a slope back, you know, coupe like. X6, you know, BMW X6 fastback design. And I spent some time talking with Matt Mustafi, who's the manager of electric vehicle programs at Audi of America. And they actually did make some changes. So it's mainly based on the existing e-tron, which, by the way, is now just called e-tron. It's not like the original Quattro Coupe back in like 83, which subsequently became known as the Quattro among fans, you know, meaning original or primitive. The e-tron that we have now is essentially the e-tron, and all the ones coming forward will have some suffix on them like Sportback to distinguish them. So one of the big complaints about the current e-tron is its range is too short. For, you know, given the size of the battery it has, you know, because Audi went very conservative, they're not using the full capacity of the battery. They only use 88% of the battery in the e-tron. For the Sportback, they've made some changes. It's going to be made some changes to the power electronics, to the battery management system. They're now bumping that up to 91% of the battery will be used. And the expectation is that the range will probably be somewhere around 215 to 220 miles, which is still not great, but it's better than the 204 that the current e-tron gets.
Right.
But one of the really cool things, which unfortunately we will not get on ours because it's a regulations, is the lighting system on there. The e-tron Sportback has these matrix LED lights that do all kinds of wild and crazy things. It basically has if you remember old projection TVs with their DLPs, the little micro mirror systems. Basically using the same kind of mechanism. It's produced by Texas Instruments, a little micro mirror system in front of the LEDs. And it's, I think it's 1.3 megapixel lighting pattern that they can do. You know, and so you can control the light pattern dynamically. So one of the things that it can do, for example, is as you're driving down the road, your high beams, you know, if you're on a, you know, dark road, you know, there's nobody else around, you got your high beams on so you can see more of what's around you. When it detects a car coming towards you, it can automatically mask out the portion of the view where that car is. So instead of shining the high beams on that approaching car, you get the high beams all around it, but not on that car. So you don't blind the oncoming driver, things like that. Another thing that they showed us that they demoed is, you know, when if a pedestrian is detected, it can actually cast essentially, you know, a light up that pedestrian so you can see the pedestrian better. You know, it can project little chevrons on the road where the lane markings are to give you more guidance, you know, where you should be, things like that. So there's all kinds of neat things that they can do with it. But of course, those lights aren't legal here in the U.S. yet. So
it sounds
maybe
like
someday we'll get cool lights, but not now.
And will they also help with autonomous driving or autonomous features?
Yeah. So, yeah. For, you know, that same kind of technology can be used for autonomous vehicles because you can actually project messages right on the road. You know, so, you know, to signal the intent of the vehicle. So if the vehicle, you know, is not going to be moving, you can, you know, put parked or stopped. You know, if the vehicle, you know, before the vehicle starts to move, you can say, you know, vehicle about to move, or, you know, some sort of short message there so that pedestrians and other road users can see, get an idea of what, you know, what the vehicle's intent is. You know, so projecting those kinds of messages. And it's a very high resolution control system, and it worked really well for the demo.
That's really cool. It's very clever. Yeah. And it worked for the demo, unlike some other demos that we saw this week.
Nothing broke. It all worked as intended. So that was good. No broken glass.
Yes.
But of course, they didn't have a designer throwing steel balls at the headlight clusters.
Fair enough.
So that is the one downside to these fancy headlight systems is that, you know, if you do get into a fender bender and you know, have to replace that headlamp cluster, you're not talking about like a $6 bulb.
Yeah. That's pricey.
They didn't talk about the pricing, but, you know, the parts prices, but you can bet these things are going to be really expensive to replace if you get into a little accident. But hopefully you get into fewer accidents because you can see better.
Exactly. It all works together.
Yeah, and it's lighting technology is something that really it's fascinating. It seems boring, but it's something that we really should have better lights on the road. Although I've been struck by the last few vehicles I've driven with halogen lights. And, you know, a good halogen system, but, you know, lamp and reflector, they're only 55 watts or 60 on high beams. Like, that's not a lot of wattage, but if they're designed well, they put the light in the right place, and they can actually be surprisingly better than a lot of the HID or LED systems that are out there. It's just what throws you off, I think, is that they look, they have that more sort of orange color temperature, where the newer systems, they burn at daylight, which is, you know, 5,600 Kelvin. So they look maybe brighter because they're whiter, but they have a patchy, crappy beam pattern, and it's all down to beam pattern. So yeah, the better you can, the more light you can put on the road and keep it there, the better. I'm really fascinated by how these new lights can sort of basically make a dot of darkness and track it and just, you know, keep the rest of the road illuminated that brightly for you. That's amazing to me.
Yeah, it is pretty cool.
The other place I've noticed the lighting is in the rear view, in the backup camera. So on that Mazda, the Mazda 3, the backup camera was so bright, it provided fantastic light for, you know, nighttime backing up. I have a Hyundai Santa Fe, and I was in my sister's driveway, so exactly the same driveway last night. And I was like, wow, this is not nearly as bright as the Mazda was.
Yeah, that can be a challenge. It's great having these backup cameras, but you know, if you're not lighting up the area where the camera is looking at, it's not really very helpful to you.
Yeah, I was kind of taken aback, but again, the Mazda had, it was definitely brighter, and I had, her driveway isn't tricky. It's just, you know, it's at night, and you want to, when you put the car in reverse, yeah, you're expecting it to be a certain amount of light there. And the Mazda did a really, really nice job of that. And I was surprised. And obviously I'll talk about the Hyundai more next week, but I was a little disappointed with the Hyundai Santa Fe. It also sits up higher, but it still was just not as bright. I don't know. But that's something that I've seen a big difference and a lot of variation in the brightness and effectiveness of the lighting in a backup camera. Not something that's talked about every day.
No, but it is something we do a lot. So, you know, it's important.
What else did you see in LA?
One other one that I wanted to talk about is the Hyundai Vision T concept. There was a lot of emphasis on electrification, like I talked about, you know, a lot of EVs. There was the Volkswagen ID Space Vision wagon, which is coming in 2022 and will be built in Chattanooga. BMW showed the Mini E, which is launches in the US early in 2020. But the Vision T is pretty cool because it shows the next generation of Hyundai's design language, you know, where they're going with their design language, which is a little bolder. And this is, you know, seen as kind of a preview of where the Tucson, the next generation Tucson, is going, probably in about 18 months or so. And there's some interesting stuff about, you know, aside from the basic design, if you look at photos of it, you know, when it's off, it looks like there's no headlights on the front. You know, you've got this kind of diamond pattern
the front. Oh, that's crazy.
Yeah, but in fact, there's some technology that they're using there, which is actually already on the 2020 Sonata, which is going on sale shortly. And on the Sonata, if you've seen the new Sonata, you know, when it's off, it looks like there's a chrome strip on either side that extends up from the headlamp cluster and runs along the edge of the crease of the hood on either side and runs to the base of the A-pillars. But the front section of that, the front portion of that, is when it's off, it looks like it's just a chrome strip, but it's actually an electrochromic coating on the back of the plastic. So it's like a one-way mirror. So when you light up behind it, it lights up like a light. And that's what they're using as the headlights on this Vision T concept, which is really neat. So, you know, you get these wild looking lights on it, and it's a great design, I think. But, you know, and then when it's off, it just, you know, kind of blends in, with the grill. And it's quite unique. I don't think it's going to be legal for headlights, as we've already talked about. But at least, you know, they're able to use it for things like daytime running lamps and other stuff, you know, to kind of hide it. And then when you turn it on, it you know, gives you some unique, you know, some interesting design possibilities.
That's very cool.
I think Hyundai design is just stunning. They're doing so good. That thing looks, I don't know what this design language is going to sell for, but you can bet it's going to be from like the 20s up to the 50s, right? It looks like $1 million. It's just so classically refined and handsome. I just, you know, they have clearly made the investment, and they're letting the investment actually, you know, they're not getting in the way of it. They're not micromanaging it. They're really letting the guys that they hire do their thing, and it's paying off. Their cars are just beautiful.
Yeah, no, they're doing some good stuff. Oh, and one other one, just to bring up as well, is from the other side of the Hyundai Motor Group family, Kia also introduced a new small crossover called the Seltos. No electrification on this one for now, but it's, you know, it's their a new compact crossover that slots in just below the Sportage, It's not as small as the Kona. It's actually about the same size as the current Sportage. And what James Bell from Kia told me is that the next gen Sportage is going to get a little bit bigger than where it is today. It's going to move a little more upmarket. But this, you know, like a lot of the other recent, you know, compact crossovers we've seen, like the Hyundai Venue, the Nissan Kicks, less so the Kicks, but you know what they're doing with this one, you know, is trying to make them more affordable to consumers, and they're doing some interesting stuff with this, you know. So you know, it's like I said, it's a little bit bigger than the Venue and the Kicks, but it's going to start at like $22,000.
Wow,
and $22,000 for the base model. That's with all-wheel drive.
Amazing,
huh?
That's a great and, price point.
You know, actually, if you want front-wheel drive, it's actually going to be in a slightly more premium trim level at a slightly higher price. So the base model, you know, unlike the Venue and the Kicks, which don't offer all-wheel drive at all, this one actually has standard all-wheel drive for $22,000. And for that price point, you know, it's actually got like modern Kias, you know, it's got a really nice interior, you know, really nicely executed. It looks like this could be a real winner.
Yeah. Well, you know, Luke Dockenwalk, I think that's how you say it. I mean, he's done a great job at leading up Hyundai and Kia and Genesis design, along, of course, with Peter Schreier, who's legendary. But they've got a fantastic group there designing these products in Korea. These guys are so international in terms of their mindset and their and where they grew up. You know, there's another designer, Sung Yip, he's Korean. And so you've got, you know, this mix of cultures, but with a lot of they have a clear vision of where they want each of these brands individually to go. And I think that we're really starting to see their design language coming into play. And it's one of the reasons why the products are getting better and better. I think Luke's been there since 2015 or so. So we're just, you know, really starting to see his vision come to light.
Yeah, I think there's some great stuff there, and it's looking forward to seeing what else comes out of the Hyundai Motor Group, aside from that new grill on the Genesis G90, which...
Oh my gosh, that thing is enormous. Yeah, it's the size of an apartment.
Overall, G90 still looks good. I like what they've... It almost has a little bustle back to the trunk, too, but I think that they've, you know, everything they do looks tasteful. It's a big girl, but I mean, you know, I'm not anywhere near as offended as everybody else is by the new BMW X7. I think that thing looks fantastic on the road. So, whatever.
I think that thing's fabulous on the road.
Big grills have happened before, and they'll happen again. Yeah. Like, whatever.
It's fine. Exactly. Yeah.
All right. Well, I think that we've covered a lot of ground. And we're edging towards 2 hours, so we should probably call it a podcast.
Sounds like a plan.
Sounds good.
All right. Well, we'll catch everybody. Please definitely send us individual Hello World emails so we can with all the information. And we'll talk to you next week. Let us know if there's anything we missed you want to talk to us about, and we'll go from there. All right. Thanks.
All right. Thanks.
Bye.